You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the S E A.
Hello and welcome to episode 407 of the Fagoist Pelton Cast, sponsored by our friends at Pagliacci Pizza. I'm your co-host, Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Carcino.
And we're once again coming to you in different locations. I'm in Seattle, Washington, home of the four-time WNBA champion, Storm.
And I'm coming to you from Renton, Washington, home of the Super Bowl 48 champion, Seattle Seahawks. Which there are a lot less of now.
Free agent. They have solidly signed free agent. Which honestly is maybe, you know, not such a bad thing. Everyone on Seahawks Twitter is freaking out and complaining that John Schneider isn't doing anything. And I'm the only one like, actually, you know what? Let's not sign free agents. Free agents are bad. Let's get comp picks.
I have some complaints about John Schneider.
Oh, okay.
I don't. Oh. My complaints about John Schneider are not that he isn't doing anything.
Fair take. But people were very unhappy about the lack of reported news on Tuesday until they signed free agent. But before we talk about the Seahawks at the top of the pod, let's start with this week's toasts, beginning with a congratulations to Corin Johnson, named the Pac-12 Sixth Player of the Year, and Keon Brooks Jr., named to the All-Pac-12 First Team with Men's Basketball Awards on Monday.
I love Corin Johnson. I can't wait to find out where he's going to be playing next year.
Maybe, if you're lucky, he'll transfer to your favorite school, Washington State.
Sadly, I don't think there's any chance of that happening.
Oh, no, definitely not. He's going, it's going to be much better than Washington State.
I will cheer Corin Johnson on, provided he doesn't go to one of two schools. I'm okay with like 100 and whatever others. There are only two schools that I will not cheer Corin Johnson on at, though.
I like your idea that the other 250 schools, it's like, how dare he go to Cal State Northridge, which we endorse, Cal State Northridge, friend of the pod.
Oh, yeah, CSUN.
Congrats to newly re-signed. Actually, I guess I was thinking Fullerton is the friend of the pod now that I think about it. Congrats to newly re-signed Kraken winger Jordan Eberle.
Why? What?
I know the
Pelton cast would like to issue a correction. a formal apology for the Pelton cast. Cal State Northridge is not a friend of the pod. Cal State Fullerton, for some reason, is a friend of the pod.
I was issuing a retraction like I was the AP talking about that photo of Kate Middleton. But it's Cal State.
You were auditorily doctored into saying Cal State Northridge versus Cal State Fullerton.
It's Cal State
home
Fullerton.
Of Travis Lee, first baseman for the Arizona Diamondbacks.
There you go.
That's everything I know about. That's everything I know about Cal State Fullerton. Why is Cal State Fullerton? Can you explain this?
The coach there, Dedrick Taylor, is a friend of a friend. So
okay. It actually was some minutia reason.
I thought you
were going to be like, there's this whatever connection that I would actually know about. You're just like, I know a guy.
Well, it's a head coach. It's not just a guy.
Still.
You know, I don't know that many college basketball head coaches. It's not like Mike Hopkins and I have ever, you know, rode in the same car to the summer league or something.
Okay. So. But you have your name dropped in the head coach of Cal State Fullerton.
I am, yes.
That's a friend of the pod riding the same car to the summer league. Wow.
Exactly.
I had there no idea we'd be here.
Me neither. Didn't expect that was going to be our destination along the way. Well, congratulations.
I know where our destination is not going to be. Cal State Northridge, that's right. Official enemy of the pod.
We have nothing against
there
Cal
are three
State
schools.
Northridge.
Three schools I will be upset if Corin Johnson signs with. like that one of them. We should revisit this in like 6 months and be like, what are the three schools you would be mad if Corin Johnson signed with? And for some reason.
Yes, I have no thoughts on Cal State Northridge head coach Andy Newman. I'm sorry. Just nothing. All right. And congratulations to Kraken winger, newly extended Kraken winger Jordan Eberle on playing his 1,000th NHL game on Tuesday. All right. This is a big one. I hope you're sitting down. I know you are, because I can see you via Zoom. Reversal. It appears Lauren Jackson now does intend to play in this summer's Olympics after previously announcing her retirement from international basketball. Per Australian newspaper The Age, quote, Basketball Australia will allow her to travel with her two boys, giving her the peace of mind she craves. the squad for the Opals Olympic team will be announced later this month.
Wow.
We'll stay
when
tuned.
When you said reversal and then you said Lauren Jackson,
I
was
just
expecting
come back
something.
To the storm.
Back to the storm. Look, this is their year. All of a sudden, Lauren Jackson's back. Do you know where her two boys can live? Seattle, Washington. We would happily welcome her two boys to Seattle, Washington. Their airplanes from Australia directly to here. One flight
there
with
is?
The boys on it with Lauren Jackson right here. I assume so. I don't know.
Qantas. I don't think so. I think you have to fly through LA to get to.
All right, that's
get
fine.
To Seattle.
That's fine. But you don't think you can fly the private, the PJ from Australia to Seattle, Washington? They've got. Look, if the gas can allow it, and this is what we're talking on the podcast now, if the gas can allow flying to LA, you could fly to Seattle on the PJ. Thank you. And her two boys could live here in Seattle, Washington. This is the year. Bring her back. Every year that it gets longer and longer, the idea of Lauren Jackson returning to the storm gets more and more unlikely. But I also love that we have to be the only podcast in the world tracking the comings and goings of Lauren Jackson in Australian basketball.
I think we're probably the only Seattle sports podcast doing this. I don't know that we're the only podcast in the world doing it.
Fine. There are probably Australian basketball podcasts tracking this.
Can I give you a 4,000 kilometers? I'm going to need that direction in miles here. There was a real Peltoncast geography moment on the Dunked On Basketball podcast, the Hollinger and Duncan episode after I appeared on it as a guest last week, where they were talking about Kelly Olynyk being a hometown player for the Raptors when Kelly Olynyk is actually from Kamloops, British Columbia. You know what that's the home of, right?
Kamloops?
Yeah.
No.
The Blazers, the Kamloops Blazers.
Of course, yes. Okay.
And they referenced
it. I didn't know what you were saying. Literally, by hometown, they meant the country of Canada.
He actually, it turns out, was born in Canada, but Nate estimated that it was 2,500 miles, which is way further than it actually is from Kamloops to
less miles.
But it also should have been in kilometers. That was my Peltoncast geography thought as I was listening to that podcast.
So do you listen to the Dunked Ons before and after you're on so that you can hear if they reference your episode?
It was the continuation of the same episode, but
okay,
yes, they did make a joke about my appearance.
I knew it.
I was
going
to listen to it anyway.
You're like, it was the one after I was on, so I had to listen in case Kevin Feld was mentioned.
Obviously, I'm listening to that regularly. They might reference me even if I'm not on the podcast.
Oh, I see.
Yeah. All right, lastly this week, a congratulations to Reign defender Quinn, who reached 100 caps with the Canada national team and a semifinal loss to the U.S. women's national team in the CONCACAF Gold Cup that was decided on penalties after the Reign's Jordan Heidema equalized for Canada in the 82nd minute. This was, by all accounts, a wild match. No Reign players were on the roster of the U.S. women's national team this time around, which went on to beat Brazil in the final and drink out of the CONCACAF Gold Cup. As was noted on the Discord, it is a true cup. It is
there
gold.
There we go.
There's truth in advertising still. All right, one last note before we get into the Seahawks. This Thursday, 3/14, is Pi Day. And in honor of that, from our sponsors, Pagliacci, order an 11-inch Pagliacci on Thursday and get a second 11-inch pizza for just $3.14.
Wow.
Be sure to take advantage of that deal.
Okay, I think I will. Don't mind if I do. I stopped at Pagliacci on, I guess... Is there any other time that we're going to be talking about college baseball, UW college baseball?
Their name is still listed on the rundown, but there's no notes about them. So yeah, drop it in here.
Let me just tell you, their performance does not warrant being on the rundown.
They're not doing it for the rundown this year.
But I went to the UW men's college baseball game on Saturday. And the best part of that experience was getting the Pagliacci on the way home. Loved everything about that. Baseball game, not so much. If I could summarize Mateo's weekend news from his school on Monday. This weekend, I went to the UW baseball game. Period. I did not like it.
Oh, no. Wow. What was so objectionable to Tay? Is he just like, I have, you know, a lot of exciting things that I could be doing?
No, he was deeply upset that there were no autographs signed. Okay. No foul balls came our way. We were definitely basically the only people in the stands. Like, I have been at children's baseball games with a lot more people in attendance than the UW baseball game, which, again, like I said, tickets should be a dollar or free. Ultimately, that's actually what people don't utilize enough, is things should be free until the demand gets there. Like, what's the point? Aren't there UW sports that are free to just walk into?
I don't think there are any that are necessarily completely free, but I could be wrong about that.
I mean, like, this is no offense to the UW baseball team, which are obviously very good baseball players. Literally, there was an entire section. It was just us. So if a foul ball came over there, we were getting that foul ball. No foul ball came over there. It was pouring rain. The fan experience, I would say, is probably a 0 out of 100. It's just like there were some people being like kind of drunk and rowdy and like heckling the players of the game, which is like literally that is their God-given right. To if they paid their ticket, they should be able to yell to the field.
But what if the ticket was free? Then would they be allowed to?
Sure, yes. It wasn't, though. I know that it wasn't. I paid to get in. But they were yelled at, and the ushers came over and were like, and they were like, we were told we could yell the people. And they were like, no, stop. It is just like all of the worst parts of college distilled down into one. The fan experience. Colleges are horrible at fan experience, number one, right? The University of Washington, more than almost any other. Thank God the football team is good, because they don't do anything else right. And so the experience of actually going to the game is horrible. All of that combined with it is outside and it is pouring rain and the team is awful. So
it was, so they're just like, rain delays are not a thing here?
Nope. I mean, they actually delayed the game 4 hours. It was supposed to start at 1 and it started at 5.
Okay.
Or maybe it started at 4 or whatever. And Carson Olin didn't start, didn't play, didn't start.
I was noting that. I went and looked at the box score and saw that your guy did not get on the field.
So, I mean, he started most every game as a true freshman.
Yes.
And this happened to be the one that he did not play in. So, and did not sign any autographs.
So, again, the Pagliacci was great.
Oh my God, Pagliacci was amazing. I'm upset that Matteo didn't write about that for his weekend news, which should have just been, I went to Pagliacci. It was great.
I think we should like maybe do a weekly Tay's weekend news segment on the pod.
I did not like it. It was just like so perfectly distilled down.
One last note before we get into the Seahawks. We are no longer saving the date of April 20th. For PeltonCast Live. We're now thinking PeltonCast Live in the fall. So just save like the entire month of September to be safe.
And August too.
Okay. All right. So the Seattle Seahawks have seen a number of goings in the first 2 days of the legal tampering period. Contracts can't officially be signed until Wednesday, except for re-signings. So we did see them announce the new contract for Leonard Williams, who re-signed for 3 years and $64.5 million, up to $64.5 million. Also re-signing tight end Noah Fant to a two-year $21 million deal, but losing Drew Lock, a one-year $5 million deal with the Giants, up to $5 million. DJ Dallas, a three-year deal worth up to $8.2 million to the Cardinals. Guard Damian Lewis, a four-year deal worth up to $53 million to the Panthers. Tight ends Will Disley, who they had waived, 3 years, $14 million to the Chargers. Colby Parkinson, 3 years, $22.5 million to the Rams. That was one of the more shocking numbers. And then linebacker Jordan Brooks, a three-year, $30 million deal to the Dolphins.
The Colby Parkinson one was one of the most shocking ones.
I think so.
No, I totally agree. I don't think any of these not signings are indefensible for the Seahawks. Can we just go through the whole... You mentioned Noah Fant in there also?
I did, yes.
It definitely felt like bringing Noah Fant back, especially after... Obviously, Will Disley was going to sign somewhere after they released him. And the Colby Parkinson deal. It felt like teams were spending quite a bit of money on tight ends. And the two positions early on after Kirk Cousins that were really going aggressively were running backs, which I think every single one was a terrible signing. Every deal that was given out to running backs was a bad deal that was given out. And then tight ends ended up getting quite a bit of money early on, which was why the deal that the free agent that the Seahawks signed today, I actually thought was probably a very good signing and maybe the only good thing that they've done this offseason, aside from releasing players. The thing that we have to hone in on, though, is obviously Leonard Williams, because that's basically all the Seahawks have done this offseason.
It's certainly their most significant move.
And I think the troubling piece of the Leonard Williams signing is that I just deeply do not think John Schneider understands the concept of sunk cost. And I look, do they like Leonard Williams? Do they covet Leonard Williams? I'm sure that they did. But to have traded that second round pick for Leonard Williams was the wrong decision in the moment when they made it. That doesn't justify then turning around and giving Leonard Williams the contract that they gave him so to justify the second round pick. And that to me is what it feels like happened here, is that John Schneider made a bad decision in the moment. The team didn't end up going on the run that they wanted to go on. And so to compensate for that, to maybe cognitively make himself feel better about the decision, gave Leonard Williams a contract that does not make sense for Leonard Williams. And who was it who gave the grade a C minus yesterday? Seth Walder.
Yeah, Seth Walder, my ESPN colleague, rated this trade and was among several people that kind of basically observed Leonard Williams is a good player who continues to be paid like a great player.
And that's what we saw on the field as well with the Seahawks, which was Leonard Williams made some plays, but at no point was he a game-changing defensive player. He is now, he's the highest paid player on the defense, right?
Yeah.
He will go into next season as the highest paid player in the defense. And the chances of him having the biggest impact of any player on the field for this defense is probably fairly low.
That's a little unfair because, you know, I think you would assume that the players who are likely to have the biggest impact for the Seahawks defense.
Deals.
Yeah. Like no one's like, well, wow, it's so amazing that Devin Witherspoon could be successful in the NFL while he's only making, you know, X million. Like, well, that's how rookie contracts work.
But there's also a value to the pick that they used on Devin Witherspoon,
which is what makes the Leonard Williams deal more costly, even than it appears that it was the second round pick plus what they're paying for him. I mean, I think I don't necessarily want to defend the Seahawks on the sign, but I will say I don't think it has to be a sunk cost issue, because part of the reason they were willing to trade a second round pick for Leonard Williams is because they valued him more than other teams did. That's why they made that deal instead of sending out a third round pick for Chase Young. And we'll see what, you know, his market eventually looks like in free agency. But so there is still higher on him now, higher on Leonard Williams now than the rest of the league. So it's not surprising that they'd be willing to pay or sign him.
Your argument is the Seahawks incorrectly valued Leonard Williams one time. So of course they'd incorrectly value Leonard Williams a second time. That's your argument right now?
I just don't think it necessarily is a sunk cost or like a try to justify the trade. I think the trade and the re-signing stem from the same place, which is thinking that Leonard Williams is a great player, which is not an opinion that is held by the majority of outside observers.
It's Jamal, and also statistically speaking as well. This is not just outsiders. Statistically speaking, he has not met that value. And the chances of him ever... It's Jamal Adams Jr. is what Leonard Williams is. It is not as costly to the team and the organization overall. I like Leonard Williams also, but this is Jamal Adams, and he's like 5 years older.
Well, yeah, that's probably the most worrying thing about this is that, yes, you know, Leonard Williams has been, you know, somewhat overpaid, but still a very good player. But you're now paying him for age 30 through 32, basically. He's going to turn 30 in June. So that's a period of time where he could be on the decline.
Have we seen how this deal is structured, where the get off money is? We don't know any of that stuff.
Don't believe we've seen that yet.
Whether it's upfront or I would hope that they're able to get off this contract after the second year, because the chances of them wanting Leonard Williams to be on the team in the third season for the dollar amount that it's going to be, like, he's going to be released. We know what's going to happen here. We all know what's going to come from Leonard Williams, because he's not going to be a valuable player by that third season. He's not going to be, and I'm saying a valuable player in terms of on the field, he will have value, but any sort of value that exceeds the contract or comes near the contract just is not going to happen. I understand you need to spend money at some point along the way, but John Schneider has consistently proven, this isn't a Pete Carroll thing now, this is John Schneider. He's on his own, right? He's running the show at this point. And this is the type of move that I think over the years, we generally thought this was Pete Carroll influencing it. And John Schneider has now done this. And by making the signing, it's sort of you retroactively look back at all of the transactions and say, maybe John Schneider isn't necessarily that good at this. So the Seahawks have had a very hard time finding value with players. And in this scenario, that it would be almost impossible for them to get extra value on the contract for Leonard Williams. He would have to play better than he has ever played in his entire career at his 33, 32 seasons to have added value on top of that contract. To meet the value of the contract from your play is still also an important thing because you have to spend money somewhere and players got to play football. But even to get to that point is going to be extraordinarily difficult for Leonard Williams.
Yeah, I mean, I think the other thing here is like the part of the justification for giving up a second for Williams, if he was going to be a rental, is, you know, it's going to take a year, but you could eventually recoup a comp pick for him. And by re-signing him, you take that possibility off the table.
The Seahawks, literally, there is nothing. The idea that the Seahawks care about comp picks,
I don't know, but
kind
it's
of laughable.
But sometimes they do. There are years where they do. Like,
when was the last time they even got a comp pick?
I don't know that I could tell you that off the top of my head, but there was a large period of time where the Seahawks actually were relatively above average at accumulating comp picks, and they've just been surpassed in their own division by the Rams and 49ers, who, you know, I think may have had the two largest numbers of comp picks in the NFL this year.
They are two of the smartest run organizations in the league, and they both happen to be in the division, and the Seahawks have learned nothing from them, ultimately.
I was thinking about this earlier and like, how would I run a team if I were an NFL GM? And I would have to be careful because you don't want to do the Sam Hinkie thing and make it too obvious that you're gaming the system. But the play would be only sign players who have been released by other teams.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Because they don't count in the comp pick formula. And then sign them exclusively to 1-year contracts so that if they leave, you potentially get comp picks for them. And if not, you just re-sign them and they don't factor in either way.
The way to build a team is through the draft. Like that is ultimately how you build a football team, right? Most of the players that you have on your roster are going to be through the draft. You add a couple of bits in through free agency. I don't think the Seahawks sitting out free agency is wrong. I think the Seahawks sitting out free agency is right, ultimately. Because who are they wanting the Seahawks to sign outside of Patrick Queen, right?
I'm sure there are players.
Austin Eckler, we are so lucky that we got to sit out the great running back transformation or whatever that happened this offseason. That was very nice and fun.
That was the upside of drafting them in the second round consecutive years.
I mean, I still think running backs are being overvalued. People aren't paying running backs on franchise tags anymore, and they aren't necessarily, well, I guess Bijan, but like, and Jahmyr Gibbs. No, teams are drafting running backs way too high still. Look, teams are just bad at this. I don't know.
And we should say, for the moment, the Seahawks are gaining 3 comp picks right now. Obviously, this is a very fluid situation, and they can't sign players to cancel them out, but they would get a 4th-rounder for Damian Lewis, a 5th-rounder for Jordan Brooks, and a 6th-rounder for Colby Parkinson, as things currently stand.
That is a we'll see. And even if they get those, I mean, it would be great if they got those 3 comp picks long-term, because ultimately, they're going to need those picks next year in the draft. This is a rebuilding team. I think the Seahawks right now are capable of, with the offense that they have, we have no idea who's playing defense for the most part because they just don't have that many defensive players overall. With the offense that they have, I like the Noah Fant coming back. I like the re-signing of Noah Fant. And I think the offense is going to be good. To me, Colby Parkinson, I don't know. Holy shit, there's an animal outside. Wait. The dog led to me being punched in the nuts by Mateo for some reason. I don't need to. The children have accused me of making up the dog in my backyard. I got them to see if they can identify the dog because they're more familiar with the neighborhood dogs. Mateo freaked out and it led to him punching me in the nuts.
Those who deny the existence of robots may themselves be robots.
I love the idea. They're like, you're making shit up, Dad. And I'm like,
what?
Is that a thing that I do?
Well, again, comp picks.
Yeah. Well, anyway. Yeah, I don't know. Sure, I'd run a team that way. The only positive of Leonard Williams was, not the only positive. I like Leonard Williams. He'll be a fine football player. It's whatever. Ultimately, it's a bad decision that probably will cost the Seahawks any sort of chance at the Super Bowl long term. But
I don't think it's that impactful. I think not having a Pro Bowl Super Bowl caliber quarterback is going to cost them any chance of
No,
that
I know.
anytime soon. With all due respect.
All of these little things matter.
Sure.
Jadeveon Clowney is still a free agent, is he not?
He is.
And if there's money that, Patrick Queen didn't sign with the Seahawks, and I'm sure what it came down to was the almighty dollar. I don't think that the Seahawks were not interested in Patrick Queen.
If they, I mean, the money on Patrick Queen was not very much, just as the money on Jordan Brooks was not very much. That seemed to me to be a we don't value this player as much
Or
as the outside world does.
we don't value this position. I mean, the position is clearly.
Could be. We'll see what they do at linebacker, where there were reports last week indicating that Bobby Wagner is unlikely to return. I mean, no, not a particularly
Who
surprising development.
is coming back at linebacker? Who are the linebackers on the team at this
Well,
point?
they were of Nick Ballore, so
Oh, fuck.
I don't know who they have.
God damn it. They got Belore too. No.
Do they have any linebackers, off-ball linebackers under future contracts? I assume they must. Patrick O'Connell, yeah, he's under contract. Drake Thomas is apparently a linebacker. That kind of seemed vaguely like my memory. So they do have some linebackers, but I don't know that there's any.
That was what you concluded from that?
Yeah.
I mean, somebody's gonna have to play the position.
I think they will be signing some free agents at linebacker. I think they will be signing
Well,
a free agent
there
at
go your
safety.
comp picks.
I mean, that's why you hopefully sign players who are released. Yeah, that's hence the strategy.
But there are players who are out there that they have to build a lot on defense. This isn't they're not one Leonard Williams in a way. In the same way that last season they weren't one Leonard Williams away from I mean ultimately making the playoffs, but
Right.
from winning the Super Bowl, they weren't one Leonard Williams away, and they're still not. And this is a roster that can't afford a Leonard Williams luxury. So that's what I mean by ultimately, this will probably cost the Seahawks a chance at a Super Bowl. But what doesn't?
Exactly. I mean, the Seahawks do still have a considerable amount of money to spend. We don't know exactly how much Leonard Williams is going to get, count against the comp. Cap. We do have a pretty good idea on Noah Fant because the structure of his contract has been reported. But they created additional cap space. Number one, with that Nick Ballore waiver that saved his $2.9 million base salary this year. Somebody who's been outstanding for them on special teams, but again, not a position you probably should be prioritizing from a financial standpoint. And then they restructured Tyler Lockett's contract. Something that didn't surprise me, but ultimately, it looks like it isn't actually costing. Tyler Lockett didn't give anything up, as far as I can tell from the way it's been reported, because he was set to make $30 million in base salary, max value of $34 million over the next 2 years. None of that was guaranteed before. Now he's got $13 million guaranteed, which presumably is a signing bonus that would reduce his cap hit this year by $6.5 million, but push $6.5 million into next year, were the Seahawks to waive him, giving him a $16+ million dead cap in 2025, were
Good
that to be
God.
the case. So again, these are moves you make if you're like, oh, we're a contender, we're a player or two away, and the Seahawks remain not close to that. But
I think they are a likely play out. If we were doing over unders right now and the line's 8.5, 9.5, I think the Seahawks are probably an over.
I don't know. I think you got to be pretty optimistic about Mike McDonald to have them as a likely playoff team. Like, even within the division, obviously the Rams will have a harder schedule than they had last season, and the
Exactly. The
Seahawks will get that
this
third place
schedule is
schedule.
the difference.
But the Rams are an extremely young team. The Seahawks are not, they are somewhat, they have some young players.
I'm
And
a
they, the
little bit
Rams,
less confident in the Rams than
which
you are.
would, what talent have the Rams lost this offseason?
I think the Rams exceeded their expectations last year.
I agree that they exceeded their expectations last year. And obviously, whether Matthew Stafford can stay healthy
Yeah,
for a full
that's.
season is still somewhat in question.
I don't know about the Rams. We'll see.
I mean, I'm sure we can look. There must be on ESPN Bet playoff odds for next year, right?
Was who are their extra games that we discuss? Well, the Falcons, I think, were one of them, aren't they?
That sounds plausible. I mean, the Rams are plus 375 to win the NFC West. The Seahawks are plus 750. So.
So their three extra games were am I looking this right? Falcons, Giants, Broncos, I believe. Falcons does look probably quite a bit harder going at Atlanta. Giants is about the same, and Broncos is about the same, if not easier.
Here's a wild set. There are only seven teams that have worse Super Bowl odds than the Seahawks. They're tied with several other teams, but those other teams are Denver, the Raiders, the newly Russell Wilson-helmed Steelers, and the Tampa Bay Buccaneers.
Wow. I think that Steelers team might be mean next year. I feel like the Steelers could be a like Super Bowl sleeper. I'm a little bit surprised by that.
So I like the Noah Fant value, especially relative to what Colby Parkinson got. There's this sense out there, and Barnwell wrote this in his tight end breakdown, that, you know, he had a down year last year because his 414 receiving yards, his 32 catches were both career lows, but he just didn't get targeted very much for whatever reason in an offense that had, you know, two veteran receivers plus Jaxon Smith-Njigba, you know, multiple tight ends in the mix. His catches, however, went for 9.6 yards per target, which was easily the best of his career.
Yeah, no, I don't agree that he had a down year. That's just like looking at the stats without fully understanding the picture there.
And I know there's a bit of a debate, and I'm on the losing side of this in the stats community, and what's the right, you know, kind of measure to use with receivers, yards per route run is the most popular one. And I agree that, you know, if we're talking about, you know, the wide receiver who you throw one deep ball to every other game, and he happens to catch a couple of them for 50-yard touchdowns. There was somebody who did that for like Carolina during Cam Newton's MVP season, who I can no longer remember that player's name, but that's like the archetype of it. And like, they've got this extremely low usage rate. Like, I agree that player is overrated by yards per target, but like Noah Fant was involved reasonably in the offense. Noah Fant can't throw the ball to himself.
Was it Robbie Anderson back then or somebody else?
No, this somebody much fringier than that.
Okay.
I can maybe look that up. And then the Seahawks, the one free agent addition that they have made thus far is tight end Pharaoh Brown to give them some depth at that position. It's a 1 year, $3.2 million base salary with $3.9 million max value. The journeyman from Oregon has played for four teams in his six NFL seasons. Brown signed with the Colts last spring, but was saved in the preseason, joining the Patriots practice squad before being elevated to the full roster. He then played 54% of the offensive snaps for the Patriots over the final eight games, finishing with 13 catches for a career high 208 yards and a touchdown, a 73.3 rating from PFF, which was higher than any of the Seahawks. Will Dissly, actually the highest rated of the Seahawks tight ends by PFF, which may be putting a little too much weight on blocking for tight ends relative to receiving.
Ted Ginn had 16.8 yards per reception and 739 yards.
That's probably who I'm thinking of, yes.
Ted Ginn I wouldn't really describe as that. But there is a value in catching deep passes.
There is, certainly. But I'm saying that like when you're actually comparing him to guys who are much more involved in their team's offense, then that's probably not a fair comparison.
I mean, he was their second leading receiver at 16.8 yards per
reception. No, I guess it isn't him. Maybe I'm not even thinking of that team.
And they went 15-1. So
his yards per target were 7.6. That's not actually any good. That's because what I'm looking at is yards per target. Maybe it was Matt Ryan's MVP season.
Just because he had a 45% catch percentage, Ted Ginn.
Yeah. So like it's got to be a product of your catching. You know, that's why yards per target is good, because it factors in both catch percentage and
yards per catch.
I may be thinking of Taylor Gabriel during the Matt Ryan MVP season.
I love Taylor Gabriel.
35
awesome.
Catches for 579 yards, 11.6 yards per target, which was better than Julio Jones's 10.9 that season.
It's a better player.
So I think
traveled like that's like almost a mile that dog jump.
Okay. So I think the Brown signing is sort of typical of what I think the Seahawks are going to do a lot in free agency, which is they like to not feel like they have to draft a specific position high because it's such a glaring need. So they'll like bring in a serviceable player at these spots where they lose a starting caliber free agent, someone that they can draft over if they find the right fit, but they don't feel compelled to go chase a specific position.
Sure. I mean, is that a good perspective? Has that worked so far?
I mean, I think Evan Brown last year was like an example of that working out successfully. Again, it would be a real good strategy if all those players you signed were waived by other teams so they didn't
Yeah.
count against the comp
They
pick
didn't have to.
formula.
If
But
they were
when they
cheap
do
and
count
waived
against
by
the
other
comp pick
teams.
formula, it's not a great strategy.
Yeah, I think there are ways to build a team, and the Seahawks are just kind of bad at those ways to build a team.
I mean, I
I mean,
think they once were very good at this.
this you're
Like,
talking about a long time ago, though. It's not that recently that they were very good. Most other organizations have completely changed everything in that time period.
I agree, but like, why would your philosophy on the value of comp picks change?
It did. I don't know why. We don't need to psychoanalyze why, but the reality is it just did.
There was like
We
one
have
random
an.
year in like 2019 where like they got a bunch of comp picks.
I think the idea of consistency for a football team and the way that they're acting is not that high. I mean, you would assume that the organization, since it's been John Schneider for a very long time, probably would be, but John Schneider has not proven to be consistent with almost anything across the board.
I suppose that's fair. If you look at the all-time history, the Seahawks are still 8th in all-time comp picks, according
Well, that's great.
to overthecap.com, right between
Yeah,
the Rams and the 49ers.
that'll be helpful. The all-time history of comp picks.
The last time they received one was 2007. No, this is only updated through 2019, so that's why they're still so high. But they had 4 in 2015, 4 in 2016, 2 in 2017.
That was a long time ago.
I agree, that was a long time ago.
Do you know how much, like, basically the entire roster is different from then? Who's left? Just Tyler Lockett?
That I don't think is relevant.
But I'm saying it is a generation of players since the Seahawks have been good at this. So if you right now are sitting in this moment on day two of free agency and you're like, I think the Seahawks are going to approach it this way. I think that is a fool's errand to say that that's going to happen. And they've told us with their actions how they're going to approach it.
I agree, but I'm saying that they are unpredictable. If your whole argument is that John Schneider is unpredictable, he's
Sure,
unpredictable
yes.
enough that this year they could decide to value comp picks.
Fair enough. They've already crossed out one of those, though. I mean, I like this tight end signing, right? Farrell Brown.
And that's the other thing is like the comp picks that actually matter are the third and fourth round picks. Like the
Exactly.
fifth and sixth, like, okay, you can generate those picks just by trading down pretty easily if you
Yes.
want extra picks in those rounds. It's
Who's the third round comp pick? Nobody, right? Damian Lewis is
or
a
fourth for
fourth
Damian
round.
Lewis at this point. But again, that's fluid. It depends on what other players get canceled out over time.
I mean, if they could end up with a fourth round comp pick for Damian Lewis, that would be great.
I agree. And that would require them not signing, three qualifying players. Or not, yeah, or one player who would be, more than the $7.5 million average value for Colby Parkinson, or the $10 million average value for Jordan Brooks, which is, I think, currently netting them a fifth round pick.
What does that have to do with Damian Lewis?
Well, like, if you sign someone who makes less than Jordan Brooks, they'll cancel out Jordan Brooks and not cancel out Damian Lewis.
Got it.
So. That's kind of the formula that you have to be thinking about here. The other way that they don't qualify is if you wait past a certain date to sign players. So that's another possibility for the
And when
Seahawks here.
is the comp pick deadline's not for a while though, right?
Yeah, it's after the draft.
I mean, again, they did used to be fairly good at this. I don't think any of those players, both Michael Bennett and Cliff Avril, were post comp pick signings, right?
I don't think so. They were signed. I think they were signed earlier than that.
Okay. Well, it doesn't matter. It was an eternity ago. Ultimately, it has not been the worst offseason and free agency for the Seahawks. I don't know if they have done anything. They have done a very good job of subtracting, I think, at the right places. And I think the subtractions have meant a lot in terms of money and haven't meant that much in terms of on the field play and outcome. So that is good. But with that money, you then need to turn around and have it impact again without the comp picks, have it help the team on the field as well.
This is definitely the Seahawks podcast that is spending the most time talking about comp picks and the most
You
positively.
think
So the
so?
remaining Seahawks free agents No, I think they mostly just want the Seahawks to go out and sign players now.
Sign players now. I don't care at all. I'm so like checked out of football. I just like pull up my phone. Me and Mateo love talking about which players have signed where. I can tell you Saquon signing with the Eagles, that was a big one for Mateo.
Is he still there? Was the or there was it was Luca that read the book that talked about how important running backs were?
Yeah, the running back is the most important position on the field. Anchor of your offense. I was like, stop reading it. I slapped it out of his hands. Blasphemy.
So remaining
like Jan when you read that one book.
Yes, remaining free agents. Obviously, Bobby Wagner is still out there. Daryl Taylor, we haven't heard anything on his market as yet. And then Phil Haynes.
I think we've heard something on Daryl Taylor's market.
Okay, Phil Haynes, who may be more important for the Seahawks to re-sign with Damian Lewis's departure, along those same lines of just have, you know, someone who can start in place.
I don't know if there was almost anybody out there that signed where I was like, oh, fuck. The Seahawks didn't. I mean, like Patrick Queen was kind of the only one, but I don't know. I just want them to go draft players, to get draft picks and go draft players.
The problem is they only have so many, you know, everyone keeps talking about, well, they lost Drew Lock. Now they need to draft a quarterback. They need to draft a tight end. They need to draft a safety. They need to draft a linebacker. It's like, you only have so many picks to draft with. And that's why trading a second rounder, not a great idea.
Good news. Or they could have just signed Leonard Williams to this exact contract. And I guarantee you Leonard Williams would have signed it. They could have just waited a handful of months and the exact contract would have been there that the Seahawks could have put in front of him and then made a pick in the second round. So dumb. You're so stupid, Seahawks.
They really believed they were that close to winning last year. And then they missed the playoffs and Pete Carroll got fired. So those are all things that happened.
I'm telling you, like, literally, if they had that exact contract for Leonard Williams, Leonard Williams hits free agency, right? The Giants, they were going to franchise Leonard Williams. If they show up with that contract for Leonard Williams on day one of free agency, he's flying his ass back from Japan to sign it with them again. So it's just like.
But they would have had to work way harder on the Photoshop.
Yeah. That was literally it, is the Seahawks just wanted it now. And every trade that is for the right, because I think Brian Burns did this also, right? It was like a second and a fifth for Brian Burns for the right to extend Brian Burns.
Using the pick, I don't know if it was literally the pick. I assume it was their own second round pick, but essentially the same value that they just got for Leonard Williams, yes.
But anytime that you're making a trade for the right to pay a player, if that player isn't a superstar pass rusher, we are talking one of the best in the league, wide receiver or quarterback, you have maybe a handful of tackles, you have made a bad trade. That's it. If you are trading something for the right to pay a player, you have made a bad trade.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, the value in trading for players is when they're under contract and their signing bonus doesn't carry over onto your cap. That's the value of trading for players.
It's just, I just don't.
Or if they're underpaid on their rookie contract.
They just, people get so excited about players. And if every player could be viewed not as, people need to start viewing players. This is the most least Pelton cast perspective. Let's stop viewing players as human beings.
They should view them as human beings, but view their contracts.
Yes.
In terms of value. I mean, what it all, like, look, it, we've talked about this before. It's teams failing the cookie test over and over again.
And I get it. You like Leonard Williams, but there's also other players that you would like. It's not just Leonard Williams is the only football player that the Seahawks would like. The three players that they could sign instead of Leonard Williams, or the draft pick that they could have drafted instead of trading for Leonard Williams, they probably also would like that player.
It's the marshmallow test. I had cookies on the brain.
I don't know.
The marshmallow
that's
test.
That's what we do in the podcast, the cookie test. And I fail every time.
Actually, you don't, because we just purchased the cookies because we're adults. my purchasing cookies today does not prevent me from purchasing cookies tomorrow.
We're adults. NFL teams are adults. They can't help themselves.
They have a smaller, their marshmallows are, their cookies are a lot more expensive than ours, I guess is what I'm telling you here.
Anyway, it's fine. It doesn't matter. Who cares?
Should we transition into our search for Seattle's best cookie?
There's nothing we're going to do about it.
It's true. But we are going to do something about picking Seattle's best cookie.
Yes, we are. That's what I was wondering about if we do the Pelton Cast in the fall, though. I don't want to put on pause. Can we do could we crown a champion without a live show?
Yes, we've done it for the spring searches in the past.
Okay.
Remember the decider came on and helped us crown a best ramen?
Zach?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. What did he order?
Sushi?
Sushi.
They were like, oh, what kind? Oh, it's still a classic.
And for the champion of our ramen search.
I wanted to introduce to you a framework for talking about our searches going forward. And that is, I've uncovered a secret thing, little known. It's called the Michelin star. But I think it's actually a useful framework.
I saw this
about
in the
this.
Notes and I was so confused. Okay.
So the way that the Michelin stars work, this was originally about like driving around to go to restaurants because Michelin wants you to drive and use their tires.
Yep.
That's why Michelin has a guide to the best restaurants. It still remains somewhat baffling to me, but that's why it exists. And so the way that they rank restaurants, like, I don't think people often talk in these terms. One Michelin star is, quote, worth a stop. Two Michelin stars is worth a detour. And three Michelin stars is worth a special journey. And I wonder if that's a useful framework for us to discuss food in the Seattle area. Obviously, like the worth a special journey is not like I'm flying to, you know, the Bay Area to go to that restaurant that politicians kept going to when they were locking things down during COVID. The French Laundry. It took me a second to remember it.
Was it French Laundry that people were going to?
Yes. But, you know, it's worth driving. Like Toshi's teriyaki is worth driving to Mill Creek for. That's why it was Seattle's best teriyaki. Whereas a lot of other teriyaki is amazing neighborhood teriyaki. It's worth a stop if you're in that neighborhood, particularly if it is your home neighborhood, but not necessarily worth the trip for because it's similar to a lot of other teriyaki that might be closer to you. Do you feel like this is a useful framework for discussing how we talk about food during these searches, or am I completely misguided in this effort to apply the Michelin stars, which will of course become we'd of course award the Pelton Cast peas?
You lost me with this Pelton Cast peas.
That's just what we'd award three of, or two of, or one
three
of.
Three Pelton Cast peas.
We couldn't award Rainier Tallboys, I suppose.
I think that seems reasonable because that is the way. I mean, you talk about worth a journey, like motherfucker. Getting to Everett, that is a journey. I'd rather fly to Los Angeles, California, than drive to Everett. So, I've said it once, and I will say it again. So, I think that makes a lot of sense. I don't know there are cookie places to me where I'm like, if I'm in the area, I will get those cookies, but I wouldn't necessarily drive to the area for those cookies.
Right.
And I do think that is a reasonable way to talk about these particular restaurants. Cause to me, we get to this point where I'm like, oh, they're pretty good cookies. Like right. All of them. And I'm just like, it's kind of tough to really, really differentiate what is what, but I do think the journey is an important piece.
All right. Well, let's talk about my journey to Green Lake to get Bell's today. Husband and wife Tomas and Brooke Perez opened Bell's in 2020 when their catering company went on pause during the pandemic and named it after their daughter. They operated out of Inner Bay when we first learned about them in July 2020. When
I know.
They
this
gave,
is a, literally, we're talking journey because they moved a lot further away.
They did. When they gave Brianna Stewart cookies to take to the WNBA Wubble that year. And for a period of time, these were our go-to cookies. We were getting them on a regular basis. They then moved to their current Green Lake location the following year. Subsequently, it's opened a second location in Madrid, which is in an unusual pair of locations, I would say.
That is definitely a journey.
They skipped way over Breton.
Mm-hmm. I can't even begrudge them for that one. That's fine.
Yeah, it's very different. So I'd only had them a couple of times.
How succinctly said, Madrid is very different than Green Lake. I did not like it. Can't argue with it.
Had you had, when was the last time you had bells?
Oh, it's been years. I mean, that partially to me maybe answers a little bit of the question about the Michelin stars because of how long it had been. But
I mean, the other thing that happened besides the moving is Treat came on the scene and
Treat opened.
Usurped our excitement about them.
No, I mean, I think it'd been since 2020, probably 2020, 2021, something like that. During that time period, though, in 2020, I was getting these cookies all the time. They were definitely destination cookies. Look, I was happy to drive around anywhere, mask up, and go get anything. So it was also a very simple drive to do. To me, I think of these cookies as so pandemic era. And as we came out of that, I didn't go there. They also moved to Green Lake at almost that exact same time. But it was nice to have them today to refresh myself on what these cookies tasted like. And I agree with you that I think Treat had kind of taken their thunder. Are we able to talk about them specifically?
Sure. I mean, do you want to? Yeah.
I really thought that they were excellent, to be honest. You know, I think we talked about, right, they're in the Hello Robin territory. They're bigger cookies than Hello Robin. I'm not exactly sure what the price point is. The ice cream sandwiches at Hello Robin were not counting. Do not. It's a great addition, but they don't count towards Seattle's best cookie. And so there's nothing necessarily special like that. They feel a little bit more in line with like the Milk Bar cookies. But when you're getting them, they're fresher. The chocolate chip cookies, the s'mores cookies, are soft and gooey on the inside, a little crunchy on the outside, the perfect size of cookie. They're perfectly cooked every single way. I think the flavor palette is excellent. They're very traditional cookies in a lot of ways, but they're kind of perfectly done to me.
Yeah, I mean, I thought they were better than I remembered the last couple of times that I had had them. Was my number one takeaway, that they were gooier than I had recalled. And I thought the chocolate chip came out really well, something I wouldn't probably normally order because I'd normally go for, you know, the more exotic flavors as if I was only getting one or two cookies. The bells, I thought, was the other standout. That was one that you didn't have because it has pecans in it. So it was a no-go for you, but that was quite solid. The red velvet is never quite as good as I want it to be. I want to love it because I love red velvet.
I will agree with you about that. The things that make red velvet great can't really be replicated in the cookie necessarily.
Right. But overall, I would say these are a solid tier two. I don't know if we've concluded what
Do
we're going
we have
to award
anything?
Instead of Michelin
Do we have
stars.
Anything as three Michelin stars right now?
I would consider the cookie, Treat, and Hello Robin as three Michelin stars.
Really?
Yes.
To me, they have to be in that same conversation then.
Okay.
I don't.
So you're putting them in the bracket right now.
Oh, absolutely. There's no bracket if Bell's isn't in it.
Okay. So it's we'll see what we do with Met Market, given your allergy to their cookies.
But I just cannot stand by Met Market having Seattle's best cookie. I'm sorry. That is just not a thing that I can stand by. It's Met fucking Market.
Not even Seattle's best cookie, Met cookies.
I think Met Market can have a very good cookie, but it is really hard for me to just be like, the Metropolitan Market has the best cookie in Seattle.
I need some independent observer to come out and vouch for me on this one. So, okay. So Chicorina is also, I think, in that group.
Yep. I totally agree.
So Chicorina, Bell's, Hello Robin, and Treat are the ones that we would have in the bracket right now.
Yes.
All right. Well, let's talk about the other cookie we had this week, which is from Little J, an offshoot of Lady J in the West Seattle Junction, which is a meat shop as well as a restaurant. Co-owner Charlie Garrison, aka Chef Charlie, had been baking breakfast items to serve during the West Seattle Farmers Market on Sundays. They then opened a full-time bakery in South Park, not far from Boulevard Park, Washington, home of the Peloton Cast, not far from Loretta's. This could be a double with Loretta's, depending on the time you're going there. They offer a wide and rotating variety of cookies. We had their two chocolate chip ones last week, and the chocolate chip cocoa nib and the miso chocolate chip, which unfortunately turned out to be very similar, but my non-nut options were a little limited on this one. What did you think?
I'm pulling up their website to look at this again because I want to look at them. I Thought they were very solid cookies. I feel like this one might warrant another stop. It didn't, you know, the one that I had, I showed it to you. There was a huge chunk of chocolate in the middle that was basically just, I don't, was that the chocolate chunk?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure if it necessarily was a chocolate chunk. Chocolate chunk is what Bell's calls theirs.
Okay. But it was too much of a piece of chocolate without it being soft and gooey. Like, I don't want to bite in and have a hard crunch of chocolate. At the same time, I didn't have it super fresh, but I didn't have the Bell's super fresh either, and they were excellent. So I thought it was very good. I had it, and I was like, this is a good cookie, but we're kind of not quite at the same level as those other ones. It is a one Michelin star or worth a stop?
Yes.
Because to me, if I'm in South Park, I would definitely go back there. It wasn't like a, I wouldn't go here again, for sure. And I especially would like to try it fresh. So I think we can have them in the one Michelin star territory of...
with a possible elevation to two.
Yes. It's difficult because, again, I think the Bell's cookies are so deftly made. And the Chicorina cookies also are... The Chicorina cookies were very similar to these cookies, but just better. And so it was a little bit hard to just know that the Chicorina cookies are out there and to know that I probably prefer those cookies.
I mean, the other thing we should say about Lil' J is it's a wide variety of baked goods, all sorts of breakfast items. So it's not like a place that specializes in just cookies. I think that kind of factors into a degree as well.
That's what I'm saying. I'm looking at the website and there's like sugar cookies that look kind of grocery store style. That looked very, very good to me. I'm excited about the idea of Lil' J's. I just, the one that I had wasn't quite at the same level as, oh, I'm looking at a place in Tulsa, Oklahoma. Never mind. That place looked great, though, if we're being honest.
It's also called Lil' J?
It's called Lil' J's Bake Shop. Okay. Lil' J.
Oh, I see. Because yes, you have to know how Lil' J is actually spelled J-A-Y-E.
That's why I want to look it up. I mean, they've got donuts that look really good. I've never been to Lil' J before, and I want to go there.
Apparently, the donuts are only certain days of the week. I believe I read they're Monday, Tuesday, and Friday. So.
Okay, so is the cookies and cream cookie?
No.
This says South Park. I'm definitely on the right fucking website.
But they rotate, like I said. When I looked at the pictures on Yelp to see, there were cookies on there that I did not see in the case on Saturday when I went. So, you know, I think it's, again, that which makes sense. I think Chicorina is much the same way there. It's sort of what we decide to cook that day as opposed to a set menu.
Breakfast. I want to go to Lil' J in general. I'm not sure if it's the Seattle's best cookie, but I want to go there overall, like these breakfast sandwiches.
I want
damn.
To go to there. Yeah, no, that's what I'm saying. I mean, there's always a line there.
Is there?
Which is part of why I was late for Mateo's basketball game on Saturday.
I don't know if it's Seattle's best cookie, but I'm pretty excited about going here for almost everything else.
Agreed. Which transitions us neatly to the final coach's corner of the first grade basketball season.
And sadly, my last game coaching, because I'm going to be in LA this weekend. And also, to send me off, the kids had to have one more ejection. And this one, we started the season, or we ended the season like we started it, with Mateo being ejected. You weren't there for this, right?
I arrived and saw Tay on the bench.
With Kaylee in there comforting him?
Yeah.
I was how many Carcinos can we fit on this bench?
Over Marco.
Four Carcinos on the bench of the game. There were more Carcinos than there were players on the bench. No, it was incredible. I don't know what happened. He came out and just started yelling. Like, it was one of those things, you know, like he was totally fine the entire day before then. And then he was like, people in the crowd keep calling me the wrong name. And it was making him very upset. And he was, look, he's a fucking first grader. And he was screaming about this, and I could see him on the court, and it was teetering. And then he'd yelled enough, and the refs were like, "It's time." they were like, "You've got your warning. You're ejected." So it was only a one quarter. Like, come and sit down. And then I put in somebody else, But I was a little bit disappointed in that one because for me, the last game coaching him of his first grade season, I was hoping that he wouldn't be ejected personally. But c'est la vie. This game was, I was weirdly into it. Like, I feel like a lot of the games, like, I have different energy as a coach, different games. This one, I was yelling and animated. Kayleen was like, it was actually too much in this game of yelling at the kids. But they just, I felt like by this part of the season, we would do things right for once. You're first graders, goddammit.
I was advertised a certain level of play.
I told you, and look, you were in the building. I told you this was a Spurs-like machine. You know, I thought you were expecting to come in there and see, and I'm not talking modern Spurs. I watched them yesterday. We are nothing like that team, but I didn't
see a 7'4" dude out there.
Classic era. That is really, there was a possession where they kept getting offensive rebounds and missing threes. And I was like, when does the time come that they get other players around Wemby? It was kind of bleak, but I wanted you to be there and to see us do our thing where we shut people down defensively. We score buckets, you know, we are on it. And I felt like it wasn't the best example of that. But so the situation is most of these teams have one or two good players. And this team had two players that were clearly better than almost anybody else. And you know me, if I see that, my number one goal is to shut down whoever that player is. And ultimately, that's what every coach should want. You should want the best players on each other. You don't want one kid running wild against somebody and then have that go back and forth or whatever. Like, you should want players to face a little bit of competition. So I go out of my way. First half, I'm like, whatever, we're fucking around here. They had less than 10 players because for me, I'm five on, five off with everybody, the entire roster. They had less than 10 players.
Unless they get ejected.
Yeah, no, it happened. It's fine. Or get sick mid-quarter. That happened too. But you could sort of game plan your roster a little bit. And if you're a coach who's not valuing winning in the game that they don't keep scoring, such as myself, you try to spread around the quarters if somebody is going to play multiple quarters rather than just your best players are playing three quarters all the time. Look, there are some more fair coaches out there, such as myself, who try to make sure that everybody on the roster does that. There are other coaches that I could just feel that they're like, oh, I don't care about winning the game. But for some coincidence, all the best players happen to be playing three quarters. That is exactly what happened at this one. So I told you we were at a disadvantage because I'm playing everybody on the roster. They've got two good players, maybe the two best players on the court, and they're playing three quarters in the game. And I make it a fucking mission to shut these kids down. And that's what we did in this game. My dogs were out there playing defense. There was the kid who's the best player on their team. I think he scored 1 point in the entire second half. And I was like, beforehand, I was like, make sure that I had the right kids matched up with him. And I was like, Alexander, shut him down. And that's what Alexander did in that ball game. You got to see yourself some defense in the second half. And the kids sent me out with a W in our final game. So I was animated. I was hyped. There were some mistakes that were made, but that's okay because we ended up on top and Mateo came back for the last quarter.
For the third quarter. When it did feel like he was teetery, especially when he got the ball stolen by his teammate, but he hung in there.
I love the idea. This is my machine, my Spurs-like machine. Occasionally, we throw the ball directly out of bounds.
Occasionally you have a turnover on the inbounds pass because multiple people are competing to get the inbound pass.
Just like Parker and Ginobili did.
Don't believe that was what Parker was competing over with his teammates.
Yikes.
All right, should we get into the roundup? Let's start with the Mariners, who got some bad news where Gregory Santos was shut down after feeling a pinch in the back of his shoulder while playing long toss on Monday. Per GM Justin Hollander, who said the timetable for Santos's return will be, quote, more in weeks than days, and that Santos will not be ready for opening day. Before that news, the Mariners had signed veteran reliever Ryan Stanek, who spent the last three seasons with the Astros, winning the 2022 title with 2.2 WAR. He had a 1.15 ERA that season, but increased to 4.09 last season. Naturally, his FIP was much worse in 2002 than his observed ERA at 3.02, but he actually outperformed it last season again because his FIP was 4.6. He gave up 1.4 home runs per nine innings, his highest rate in a full season. Stanek has always been walk-prone, 4.5 career per nine innings. That's interesting because the highest rate for a Mariners pitcher who threw more than 14 innings last season was Taylor Salcedo at 4.3, so we'll see if they can get some better control out of Stanek, but looks like he may be someone who will be involved because of the injuries in the bullpen we've seen so far in spring training, with Matt Brash still not yet fully back either.
Also, Ryan Stanek, named after Ryan Sandberg. Not Ryan.
But does he pronounce it that way?
That's how Ryan Sandberg pronounces it, doesn't he?
You just said it as Ryan.
Ryan, not Ryan. Ryan. Is that how you pronounce Ryan Sandberg? Coug legend, I believe, right?
I think so. He's definitely from Spokane. His pronunciation, Ryan Stanek's pronunciation, does not include any note about Ryan.
He's named after Ryan Sandberg, though.
He is named after him, yes.
So if Ryan Sandberg is pronounced Ryan Sandberg, his name is pronounced Ryan Stanek.
Baseball Reference does not have any pronunciation whatsoever on Ryan Sandberg. So I think it may just be pronounced Ryan. Did he play at
how
Washington?
Is Ryan Sandberg the things that pop up doing? I guess tell me. I'm curious about that too.
He was drafted out of high school though, so he did not go to Washington.
Ryan sounds like R-I-N-E. Ryan Sandberg. That has to be why are you disputing this obvious correct information? He's just a Pullman legend, not a Coug legend.
Yes. No, he's Ryan a Sandberg. Spokane.
Oh, okay. Spokane legend. Well, he's a Washington State. The 509. We'll yep. Toast to him in the 200 episodes. What episode are we on?
407. We still got a race to go. A solid 2 years to go on that one.
Well, just don't forget to.
Oh, I don't know. This pronunciation says Ryan, so maybe it is Ryan.
Which pronunciation of Ryan Stanek or Ryan?
Oh,
Stanek?
Now I'm seeing on Reddit that he decided to change the pronunciation to Ryan at one point. So I don't know.
Ryan Stanek did.
Yeah.
How dare you, Ryan Stanek? You're a professional baseball player, and you're named after another professional baseball player.
No, I guess that's not him. That was referring to someone else.
That was just a guy named Ryan.
Yeah. I don't know all right, we're going to need to do more research on this one.
His nickname is Rhino, like Ryan Rhino. You're not disputing how Ryan Sandberg is pronounced, right?
Not really, no.
You're just disputing on Stanek.
Yes.
This will be an ongoing issue for the entire year, I'm sure.
I don't know if it is, actually.
God.
The Seattle Kraken, we recorded
signed
just
a letter of intent to Wazoo.
Oh, okay, there you go.
I think that is in this. Do we claim Martell Webster?
I suppose so.
I think you'd have to claim, because he never chose not, like, he ultimately didn't go there, but it was because he was drafted.
This would have to be more like, because I was going to say, Sandberg isn't from Pullman specifically, whereas Martell Webster is from Seattle. So we claim him whether he went to UW or not. I was trying to think of somebody who's not from here who signed a letter of intent but went pro. I don't have anybody off the top of my head. Because we claim Matt Tuiasosopo. He's local enough.
We'll claim anybody. No, he's Coug legend, Ryan Sandberg. That's
okay.
It. Yeah.
The Kraken we recorded just ahead of last Friday's trade deadline. They ended up making no additional moves because they signed Jordan Eberle, the aforementioned 1,000 game career, to a two-year $9.5 million extension rather than trading him. A little bit less money than he had made on his current contract, but at age 33, not surprising that he would take a slight pay cut. The Kraken lost the opening game of their homestand 3-0 to Winnipeg last Friday after the deadline. They then led Vegas, one of the teams ahead of them in the playoff race, 4-2 in the third period earlier Tuesday night, but allowed the tying goal with 16 seconds left in regulation and lost 5-4. slipping 9 points back of the Golden Knights and LA Kings for the eighth and final playoff spot.
This team, they're not making the playoffs.
They're not. Homestand wraps up with games against Washington, Nashville, and Buffalo in the next week. Seattle Sounders didn't score last week, but not their fault this time, as Saturday's game was postponed due to pitch conditions in Philadelphia in the fifth minute.
What?
It was just a driving
wake
rain
up.
Storm.
What do you have to say for yourself?
Well,
I guess it's not always sunny, huh?
No, definitely not always sunny. Because the match started, the Sounders will be limited to players on their match day roster when this game is resumed. That's important because starters Pedro de la Vega, Joao Paulo, Albert Rusnak, and Stefan Fry all sat out this one. But the news on the Sounders injury is looking better. Rusnak returned to full training on Tuesday. Yarmar Gomez Andrade could also return to the lineup Saturday against the Colorado Rapids after he was available off the bench last week. And it's possible Stefan Fry and Joao Paulo could return for Brian Schmetzer. The Rapids finished last in the West in 2023, but have taken 4 points from their first three matches, winning 2-1 at Salt Lake last Saturday. Seattle Reign FC getting ready to open the NWSL regular season. That begins on Saturday. A very exciting season for the NWSL on ESPN and ABC, those family of networks this year. So that's very exciting. The Reign beat the Huskies 2-1 in a friendly last Wednesday, with Bethany Bolser delivering the winning goal from the spot in the 80th minute. A little troubling.
Wait,
even.
What are these words you're saying?
They played the Huskies in a friendly.
The Huskies women's soccer team?
Correct.
Okay.
I needed a goal to pull it out. Of course, they were missing several players who were on international duty. No update from Saturday's friendly at the Portland Thorns, which was closed to the public. That was the last tune-up before the Reign opened the season Sunday by hosting the Washington Spirit. Washington finished 8th of 12 teams in the NWSL last season. Of course, we're adding two expansion teams, Bay FC and the return of the team in Salt Lake City. The Spirit, currently playing under an interim manager, is Jonathan Heraldez, finishes his FC Barcelona season before taking the helm of the team this summer.
Okay.
It's like Messi finishing out the season before coming in mid-year, although sadly there's no Leagues Cup for the Washington Spirit to potentially win. The Reign are tied for the sixth best NWSL title odds at plus 1200 at ESPN Bet after seeing Megan Rapinoe retire, Rose Lavelle and Emily Sonnet both sign with Gotham FC. So it'll be a very different look to the roster this year for Reign FC, as well as, of course, the return to that Seattle Reign FC name with their still yet to be completed sale from OL Group. So excited to follow along with the Reign this season. UW softball, the Huskies took 2 of 3 from Arizona State in their opening series of Pac-12 play. Lindsay Lopez spun a four-hit shutout against her former team on Saturday, but Ruby Malin allowed 4 runs.
I could have been there instead, the exact same time that I was at the UW baseball game.
Yeah, that was your mistake. Carson Olin didn't play in that one either.
I did not like it.
Ruby Malin had 4 runs in an inning of relief work Sunday, taking her second loss of the season as the Sun Devils won 9-3. As a result, the Huskies slid 3 spots in the polls to number 8. This weekend, Huskies headed to the desert to take on number 25, Arizona, which took 2 of 3 at Oregon State last weekend, losing the opener 3-2 in 8 innings. The Wildcats' non-conference losses came at Louisville, twice at Alabama, as well as at home to Arkansas. One bit of UW football news. This was speculated beforehand, but now official. The spring game will be scheduled for Friday, May 3rd at 6:30 p.m. So going for a Friday night instead of the traditional Saturday afternoon spring game.
Is that a little bit later than usual?
Yeah, I don't know if we've talked about this on the pod, but with basically the degree of turnover and Jed Fish coming in, he decided to push it back so that, you know, in the past, sometimes they've split it up before and after spring break, had that issue. This time, they're just entirely going to be in the spring quarter. And later than usual. Yeah, usually it's the first weekend of the NBA playoffs, so it would have been like April 20th this year.
Wow. The NFL draft is really a long time from now.
April 27th or
26th?
27th. Yeah.
Free agency is going to happen, and it is just a long time of waiting for the draft.
There'll be so much draft talk. All right, let's wrap up with UW men's basketball. The Huskies made it official on Friday, hours after we recorded last week. Mike Hopkins will not return for the final season of his contract in 2024-25. Do we want to talk about the Hop era? Like, we didn't really do that last week, even though we were acknowledging this was almost certainly going to happen.
No, we don't.
You don't even want to revisit the high points?
We can't. If you've got notes, I don't want you to have written notes and then not be able to read them. But
I don't have written notes. It was the one time we did
an
emergency pod after the Arizona game.
The high point. Let's revisit the high point. Three.
I mean, the whole following season was a high point. Getting back to the NCAA tournament, beating Utah State in the opening round. Interesting twist, perhaps. And then, it's so funny. I don't feel like there's ever been a coach who's gone from winning two consecutive Coach of the Year awards to on the hot seat as quickly as Hop. That second one came in 2019. It was the 2020-21 COVID season where I don't remember what their record was, but I know that it was extraordinarily bad. That was kind of the beginning of the end. And ever since then, it's been kind of a question of when this would happen, not necessarily.
I mean, weren't they like the last team to play a game? Like, they got eliminated from the Pac-12 tournament and then everything shut down.
They weren't quite the last team, but it has always bummed me out because, like, if they hadn't played that game, you could have always been, they could win the Pac-12 tournament and then go on and win the NCAA tournament. We'll never know.
The Hop tenure. You just put a bow on the losing. Yeah, I don't really know. What are the, are there other high point?
But I would say, like, up through the non-conference of the following season, before Quad A Green became academically ineligible, you were feeling really good about the Mike Hopkins era.
That's actually what the Mike Hopkins era is it's like, until player got hurt, until player was academically ineligible. Like, I mean, honestly, like, if Frank Kempnong doesn't get hurt this year, maybe it's a different season. Oh, you know, the team isn't awful this year, but he just hasn't been able to build a program. And maybe this is a reality of college basketball in general, that it's extraordinarily difficult to build a program overall and to feel like you have any sort of consistency. You know, I think it's probably...
We'll talk in a second about the difficulty of building a program with continuity. I don't think that's unique to UW, but other teams still manage to win more games.
Yeah, they eventually, even if you don't have continuity, eventually, occasionally have a good team. And, you know, you see something like Iowa State being ranked in the top 10 or whatever. And that's just, they haven't found themselves randomly in a good situation. The arena is dead. There's no excitement around the program at all. It's going to take somebody new coming in and doing quite a bit of work. I don't know if I would use the term sleeping giant. We talked about this last week, but I think there is potential for UW to be a team that can occasionally make an NCAA tournament. And
yeah,
they've been worse. He made the NCAA tournament one time in his tenure.
One time. Is that right? By the way, your beloved
years.
Cougs played the last game on March 11th, 2020, beating Colorado 82-68 to close out the night. So they could have won the national championship.
Went forever. Yeah. Was that Kyle Smith?
Yes, that was Kyle Smith's first year there.
Yeah, that's a person who can build a program. Your beloved Cougs. It is so funny that now, we're just kind of beyond everything. Obviously, if they beat UW football, I mean, they will beat UW football at some point, you know, but like, the whole thing has really, it's taken on a different tone. They don't feel like I feel like that rivalry has been taken from us a little bit, and that's a good thing. It's like, we kind of are on each other's side. Unless you ask a Coop fan. But I do think this is kind of a reality across college basketball. It's more just Mike Hopkins hasn't ever felt that connected to any of us. I don't think we ever, like, there's never a moment where, even when things were good, where we were like, wow, I love Mike Hopkins and what he's doing. The style of play wasn't particularly fun. They were never able to shoot. He never developed any sort of talent or any sort of culture around the program. And now he's gone.
I mean, it was joke for a period. I'm like, eventually, I think he did, you know, recruit some good players from the Seattle area. But like, the good players they got in the early days were mostly from upstate New York. I think the other thing I'd say is, like, This is a crucial moment for UW men's basketball. You talked about there not being any buzz about them right now. That's in a world where there is no other, you know, high-level basketball, men's basketball being played in the city of Seattle during the winter months. Like, I don't know when. Sonics are coming back, and they have until that moment to capture some fan base. Because if you don't have any buzz when there are no Sonics to compete against, you have no chance when they exist.
I actually wonder if that's not true. I wonder if the Sonics being here might actually be better for UW basketball. The fucking Kraken, like, these are not the the buzz comes from winning and people being excited about the sport of basketball in Seattle. You know, like when Sean Kemp and Gary Payton were playing basketball in Seattle, granted UW wasn't very good at the time, but like there was an excitement around basketball in Seattle. There's a whole generation of kids who are really good basketball players that are basically, it started with Kemp and Payton. Like, they are a Kemp and Payton generation.
I mean, it didn't start with Kemp and Payton. It actually started with Wilkins and Watts and Johnson, and a number of their progeny played for Washington teams
that
in the
90s. But the excitement around kids playing basketball in Seattle, it felt like the 90s was a huge time period in that. And it really helped build the culture that we have of basketball overall in Seattle. And there are obviously good players in Seattle playing basketball. You know, Paolo Banchero is the number one pick in the draft 2 years ago from Seattle. So it's a thing that can happen. And I do think there being excitement at the pro level might actually be helpful for UW overall. I don't think that there's like people who are interested in basketball and they're like, well, I will be interested in one of these teams. They're going to be interested in anybody who's good. And
I mean, yes, but what I would say is, like, even as compared to the 90s, there's a lot more competition for sports attention now than there was then. The Sounders were not playing in the MLS. The Rain did not exist. You know, the Storm didn't exist in the 90s.
Draws eyeballs, though. That's what matters.
I will say I was wrong ultimately.
How many people have you talked to about the Kraken lately or the Sounders?
I actually talked about them on the low post today.
Which team?
The Kraken. UW football.
What about you're like the extension? You like played 1,000th game and then got extended. What could you have talked about?
I mentioned the Winburn trade. I did.
What?
Zach enjoys a good Kraken update. I was a little surprised by UW football's ability to break through, because one of my thoughts was that in a time where there is so much pro sports here and Seattle is such a transplant city, that UW sports just could never have the same citywide relevance that they had in the 90s when Seattle was a much smaller and a much more, provincial city. And UW football did prove me wrong this year. Like, people got into it. But you know what I don't think hurt? The fact that the Seahawks weren't all that good this year.
People were going to be hyped on the Huskies. No, but they went to the fucking national championship.
Well, they went to the college football playoff in 2016. I don't think the city was abuzz about UW football then.
Not winning a big game changes things. And Kalen DeBoer, everything I said about Kalen DeBoer at the beginning of this podcast season is still true. It started in September. That's when our season start. At the beginning of this podcast season, when talking about Kalen DeBoer, he was able to win big games, and people like winning big games. When you make the college football playoff by beating Colorado in the Pac-12 championship, it was a different Pac-12 then too. They didn't limp their way in. The team warranted it, but they really didn't stand a chance when they got there. And they never won a big game. They didn't even really have a chance to win a big game, but they had game day here and they lost to USC.
So Chris Peterson's big mistake was not having Oregon. Well, I guess Oregon couldn't have played in the Pac-12 championship. He should have changed the Pac-12 rules so he could have played Oregon in the Pac-12 championship in 2016.
Also didn't beat Oregon as consistently as Kalen DeBoer did.
I mean, he beat him as many times. I guess no, he didn't, because it was 3 for DeBoer.
Took a lot more chances to do that also.
Yeah. He inherited a program that was built by Kalen.
But that's all I'm saying. Look, we can give credit to everybody along the way. Winning the big games, if there's a big game and people are hyped about it, and then you lose, you lose a little bit of that attention. But if there's a big game and people are hyped about it and game day is here, and then you beat Oregon, all of a sudden people are a little bit more rapturous about it. And you beat Oregon again, and you beat Texas. That's how you get people excited about it. Winning matters. And that's why people weren't excited about Mike Hopkins. He didn't win.
I agree.
He didn't win, and there was nothing tethering him to. Is Juwan Howard going to get fired, by the way?
No, apparently not.
Are you kidding me? This is, we care about Big Ten news now. But that's always the like Will Conroy thing where I'm like, I secretly don't want Will Conroy as the head coach of the University of Washington or any current ex-player, because I'm like, I just want to like Will Conroy. Let's just leave it there. And if Will Conroy won, that would be amazing. And that it would bring excitement around the university. But like, having a coach who's from the outside, I mean, there is nothing attaching us to Kalen DeBoer except for winning football games, right?
Except for Jay Kaner.
Yeah. But you understand what I'm saying? Like,
I do.
We don't need to give a shit about who the coach is.
But they do need to be able to recruit in the Seattle area. That I care about.
Kalen DeBoer.
Well, not in football. You don't need to be able to recruit in the Seattle area. There's not the same commensurate level of talent out of the Seattle area in football.
I don't know if to be a popular program, you even need to you need to recruit in the Seattle area. If you can recruit well enough from other areas and win games, people will still like you, and eventually the recruits from Seattle will come. If you have to build it that way, where it's recruits from outside of Seattle, and then you're good enough to be able to get the recruits within Seattle, it's hilarious that like the recruits are so good in Seattle that any coach couldn't get them. But we're talking about high-level recruits from Seattle, of which there are often a lot of players. So, but no matter how you do it one way or the other, winning games is what matters, and that's what Mike Hopkins wasn't good at.
I agree with that. I mean,
matter why or how. He just wasn't good at winning, and that's why people didn't give a shit about the program.
I agree. I think it's going to be much harder, even if you win games, to break through the attention economy in Seattle sports now. That's my position. It's going to get that much harder when the Sonics come back.
It also these things take time. I don't buy that it's going to be harder when the Sonics come back, because I think the attention economy is always going to be drawn toward teams that win. But you get these little blips along the way, and it's about kind of building a long-standing fan base, right? When we were kids, the Seahawks were a joke, right?
Yeah.
But the run in, like, Dennis Erickson bumped it up a little bit, and then the run with Mike Holmgren, that Super Bowl, they weren't the Seahawks then, though. They made a Super Bowl, but they weren't the Seahawks in the way that they are now. And then the Legion of Boom, Pete Carroll, Russell Wilson run, then they became the Seahawks, and it really was this incremental growth. You can lose that by being bad for an extended period of time. But right now, there's an entire generation of kids who grew up with the Seahawks being the most important team in the city of Seattle. And we're starting to see that a little bit with the Huskies, too, because there's an entire generation of kids who've now grown up, and aside from one year, the Huskies have been pretty good for a long time and very good for other short periods of time. So they haven't been a joke at any point, really. And that's, I think, what will have to happen. But I don't think the amount of eyeballs matter. I think it's about having these moments and a consistency with it.
If they had the current Pac-12 championship rules, the Huskies would have played Colorado in 2016. That wouldn't have changed. In 2018, the Pac-12 championship would have been UW versus Washington State, a rematch of the previous weekend's Apple Cup.
That would have been awesome, though, right? How much did we beat them in the Apple Cup, by the way?
Was that the one where it snowed?
It was the one in the snow, and we kicked
their 28. Ass. It was 28-15. We shut down. That was Gardner Minshew.
Woo!
Threw for 152 yards.
They might have beat us around two, though. I don't know.
I mean, they would have stood a better chance not in the snow, frankly, that team. But UW would have been favored.
That would have been really fun.
All right, so one candidate for the UW coaching job I was remiss in not mentioning last week is Boise State's Leon Rice. A Richland native, Richland High, former longtime Gonzaga assistant.
Episode 509. Can you believe that?
Washington State product. The Broncos, who have never won an NCAA tournament game in program history, currently an eighth seed.
Can't be true.
Bracket. It's 100% true. I seen them play an NCAA tournament game. They lost. They lost to Memphis 2 years ago. After losing in the opening round each of the last 2 years, they also played in the first four in 2013 and 2015 under Rice, who's been in Boise for 14 seasons, finished below 500 just twice. A fifth NCAA tournament appearance this year would match the entire total in program history for Boise State prior to Rice's arrival. So, like,
do you think that him being a little bit older is, like, how old is Danny Sprinkle?
Danny Sprinkle is not as quite as young as I think you would think he is, based on his up and comingness. He's 47.
I mean, that's still 13 years younger than Leon Rice.
Yeah, Leon Rice is 60. That's like wherever, if he leaves Boise State, it's probably, you know, his last job.
I mean, this is, it's kind of like Chris Peterson is literally went to right. Chris Peterson went to Oregon. Am I right about that?
Correct. Or no, he didn't.
At least coached early on at Oregon.
Yes. He went to like Sac State, right?
Oh yeah, that's right. I think he did go to Sac State. Alma mater of, wait, who's,
oh no, UC Davis. I'm sorry. I'm their arch rival. Wow. I just pulled a Northridge Fullerton on this one.
Wow. who's the quarterback who went to Sac State though?
The one who transferred to UW?
Did he transfer to UW? Was it Troy Williams? Detroit? No.
Kevin, there was like Kevin Thompson or something.
Oh yeah, Kevin Thompson.
And it was like a big deal because it was deep COVID, so we did not have a lot else to talk about.
Was Kevin Thompson even from San Francisco, though?
No, anyway, I'm pretty sure he was from FAT.
It's the most Chris Peterson-like of all the hires.
I mean, he's not had, obviously, the same level of success that Chris Peterson has had. But, you know, even though he would probably be viewed as kind of a secondary choice, I think Leon Rice has a very good resume. I mean, he'd be an interesting candidate for Washington State if Kyle Smith leaves, although I don't know if Washington, Boise State to Washington State is an upgrade at this point. So there's still lots of buzz about Danny Sprinkle, who was named the Mountain West Steve Fisher Coach of the Year this week ahead of several other possible UW candidates, including Rice and Colorado State's Nico Medved. Sprinkle was previously the Big Sky Coach of the Year in 2021-22 at Montana State. And I think I was underselling like the job he's done this year, because I was just noting like Utah State was really good last year under Ryan Odom, has been good for a long period of time. Craig Smith was there before that, before going to Utah. But what I didn't realize is none of the top six Aggies from last year's team in minutes played returned. Two graduated.
Also from Pullman? What in the fuck?
Well, we'll get to that. Yes, born in Pullman. Two transferred to play for Odom at VCU. Two others, I think his dad was an assistant coach at Idaho at the time. Two others transferred elsewhere. So they started the season, they rank higher only than New Mexico State in minutes continuity per KenPom. Started the season ranked number 101 in the KenPom rankings, have climbed all the way to 44th, won the conference title outright this year. So it has been a really impressive coaching job this season from Danny Sprinkle.
And I'll tell you who this is. Successful at small colleges before then. Very small colleges. You know, in the plains. Goes to Utah. Successful for a year. Short period of time as head coach. Ready for a bigger opportunity. This is the Kalen DeBoer hire. And
wow, you know where he coached? Both Northridge and Fullerton.
Wow. What? Like the Montagues and the Capulets. But this is the Kalen DeBoer hire, somebody who very short period of time, not a lot of history as a head coach at a major college basketball level, but very, very successful in a short period of time. And I he's going to be the coach. I will tell you that is all that I've heard. It's everybody's talking about it. Sprinkle, sprinkle, sprinkle. You get me the confetti cupcake cookie, right? From Bell's. Like it has been all about Danny Sprinkle. He's going to be the coach.
I don't know that he's going to be the coach, but
he's going to be the coach. Give me odds right now. It's like minus 500.
I just don't think it'd be that high, low for any one candidate. I would say maybe minus 200.
I keep getting push notifications from ESPN being like, Danny Sprinkle's high on the list. Like, either Danny Sprinkle has a very good agent, or this is much further along than you realize it is.
I mean, that'd be great.
There might not even be a coaching search. There might just have been a Danny Sprinkle is ready to come to UW. Troy Dannon has had this conversation. Mike Hopkins was informed of his release. The second these two people are done playing basketball games, Danny Sprinkle will be the coach of UW.
Well, let's talk about why Danny Sprinkle would want to come to UW, despite it not being a sleeping giant in your mind. His dad, Bill, played defensive back at UW from 1965 through 68.
Yeah, Bill Sprinkle, baby. That's Husky legend Bill Sprinkle, who I just heard of to you.
Bill Sprinkle returned to win two letters after an Achilles rupture in fall practice ahead of his sophomore season.
Oh, the grit on Billy Sprinkle.
I also got to imagine the Achilles surgery was probably not great in 1966. Sprinkle had four interceptions in 1968, which was when UW cornerback Al Worley established an NCAA record that I believe still stands with 14 interceptions that season. Sprinkle also returned 13 punts as a junior in 1967.
And lives in Seattle now?
Is that the case?
So according to LinkedIn, he's a system network administrator for the Department of Navy. This probably is a different Bill Sprinkle.
I can't speak to that.
No, that definitely is.
Does it say he went to the University of Washington?
The National Football Foundation. No, he's very old. As a player, a high school coach, a high school athletics administrator, and successful business leader, Sprinkle's support and passion for Montana's young people have earned him the respect of the people across the state. This is the NFF Chapter Leader Awards of the Montana Chapter of the National Football Foundation. He must be in Montana now.
That's where Danny was born and went to Montana State before coaching there. That's his alma mater as well.
There's also a, I assume, AI-generated Sports Illustrated article that says, who is Danny Sprinkle and what's his connection to UW from March 3rd?
Yes, I've seen that. I'm familiar with it. His Facebook seems to indicate that he still lives in Helena, Bill Sprinkle. So
yeah. I just scrolled through Facebook a couple weeks ago. I just downloaded it. And I was like, what's going on over here? Wow, there are still some people posting there.
I guess he was a redshirt in 64, according to this Great Falls Tribune article that I have seen. So he wasn't listed on the roster, but he was part of that at that point.
It's Danny Sprinkle. He's the one. I mean, he's got the UW pedigree with his dad. He's got the small college success, the transformation at Utah State. Bring it on. Let's see what Danny Sprinkle could do. He's the coach to lead Husky basketball into the Big Ten.
There you go. All right. Well, I mean, for now, the Huskies do have to play the end of their Pac-12 games.
He was also born
in Seattle. I'm just learning this from the Great Falls Tribune article. This is very useful.
No, he was born in Pullman.
No, Danny Sprinkle was born in Pullman. Well, his dad's coaching died in him. Bill Sprinkle was born in Seattle. So, yeah, a lot of signs pointing that way. So the Huskies do have to still play some games in the Pac-12, or at least a game in the Pac-12 tournament, with Mike Hopkins continuing to coach out this season. They are the number eight seed, which is the lowest they could have possibly finished after beating Washington State. Favored by KenPom to beat USC 60% of the time. But the Trojans have won their last three games, sweeping the Arizona schools at home last weekend with a 13-point win over Arizona.
Really?
Yeah.
I had that on for a second, and then I didn't pay attention.
Some good minutes for Bronny off the bench in that one. Isaiah Collier playing well. DJ Rodman had a big game. Obviously, this winning streak started with their win at Heck Ed against the Huskies. The winner of that 8-9 game will face Arizona in the quarterfinals on Thursday. These are at 12. Wednesday will be at 12 noon, and right. Thursday would be at 12 noon if the Huskies win.
I'll turn it on. It's the best part about working from home. I kind of like middle-of-the-day sporting events now.
Did you catch the Big 12 Women's Championship? Apparently that was on this afternoon, Monday afternoon. Not as many eyeballs as that Iowa Big 10 Championship game, which I did watch on CBS. That was quite good.
Are there other candidates that are even worth considering right now? And where is Utah State? Ignoring UW, who cares? Ignoring UW, where is Utah State in bracketology right now?
They're a 7 seed.
Wow.
So they're comfortably in, I think, pretty much no matter what happens.
I mean, you could see why Danny Sprinkle would be higher on the list than somebody like Leon Rice, right?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I mean,
is there a concern that there are better jobs out there? Or what is right now the college basketball, not just West Coast, what is the college basketball pecking order of coaches?
Well, the biggest concern, if you're thinking of the West Coast specifically, would be if Mick Cronin decides to leave UCLA to go to Louisville.
And then Danny Sprinkle could possibly be in the mix for UCLA.
I would think UCLA might aim a little higher than that, but
yeah, that to me doesn't make sense as somebody who's that's why UW is kind of the perfect job. I mean, that's why they're the perfect job for Kalen DeBoer as well, where it's somebody who is ready to take that leap, but this isn't like 4 or 5 years, you know, this isn't like somebody who's done Brad Stevens, right? Who's been in a small college and has been to the NCAA championship game. This is a good run and is a 7 seed and transform the program, but it's not as much of a lock that he's a great coach, but UW can take that risk and take that opportunity because of the pedigree and because of where the program is at ultimately. But to me, he's much more of a proven commodity than somebody like Mike Hopkins was. Mike Hopkins didn't have an identity at all outside of Jim Boeheim.
Yeah, I mean, I think some of the reporting has indicated that head coaching experience will be a focus for UW this time around. Not a surprise. Teams tend to hire the opposite of the coach they just got rid of.
I think Troy Dannon might be him, though. I'm telling you, Troy Dannon is done. We'll see. Literally none of the coaches he's hired have coached a game.
Also hasn't hired Danny Sprinkle. Still, to be clear, has not hired Danny Sprinkle.
What a job with this firing, though. I'm telling you, Jen Cohen had this. I mean, if Danny Sprinkle is the coach, whomever is the coach, works out well and it's great. Whatever happened is perfect. It's like the Russell Wilson trade. It's like Jamal Adams, the domino Jamal Adams to Russell Wilson to Devin Witherspoon, right? We're happy with how it worked out.
Jamal Adams gets traded to the Seahawks. Russell Wilson plays for the Steelers.
Russell Wilson is going to be awesome on the Steelers. That is a playoff team.
I was more excited about him with the Falcons. Also, remember, this is the guy who, like, I mean, I guess he doesn't necessarily, it's not that cold necessarily, but the wind and everything at Heinz Field, that doesn't seem ideal.
He
should have gone to a dome.
Russell Wilson looks natural on the Steelers. Like, the second that they announced it, I was like, he just feels very Steelers-y to me right now. You know, he's kind of like thick. Like, he just looks very normal in a Steelers jersey. Throwing it, like, handing the ball off a lot, throwing a deep ball to George Pickens. I Russ Wilson is going to be a Pro Bowler next year. Mark me down as a lock for the Steelers over.
Okay.
Well, I'm excited about that team.
We've still got almost 6 months to even see what the
until the draft. I'm excited about that Steelers team though. Mike Tomlin and Russell Wilson together. Come on. You can't tell me it doesn't seem fun.
I'm not saying it doesn't seem fun. I just feel like weather-wise, it's not a great fit for Russell Wilson.
I don't know. I think he did do really bad and just like desultory rather, but I think this could be different. Anyway, I'm excited about, after reading more about Danny Sprinkle, I'm excited about Danny Sprinkle knowing that he has the UW pedigree, being from Washington State, he'll understand the region well. And if he's somebody who that quickly has turned around, look, it can be luck or whatever, but having turned around Utah, not turn around, having rebuilt Utah State so quickly, I think is a pretty huge deal. And I think he's ready for this opportunity. And I think UW basketball is ready for a moment to be a more significant program.
I agree. On that note,
I got to go find that dog. Thanks for listening.
Thanks.